This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Hugh Remington. Welcome to the Roundtable. Australia, in our own mythology, is the nation of mates, of egalitarianism. Every man his own master, everyone gets a fair go. The idea that we are a class-bound society where life chances are set at birth, well, that doesn't sit with us at all. Even in Britain, Tony Blair declared the class war over back in the 1990s. But the signs are class is back in Britain, if it ever left, with new research showing why it is proving so hard to crack. And new studies in Australia show we are much more class conscious than we like to let on, with growing wealth disparities widening the divide. So let's talk class today at the round table. And please, if you've got a view on it, an experience from your own life, please text us with your own thoughts and experiences on 0418 226 576. Joining us on the panel today, Sam Friedman, Associate Professor with the Department of Sociology at the London School of Economics. He is the co-author of a brand new book, brilliant title. It's called The Class Ceiling, Why It Pays to be Privileged. Professor Tony Bennett has been looking at this in Australia. He's with the Institute for Culture and Society at Western Sydney University. And Associate Professor Nicholas Biddle is the Deputy Director of the ANU Centre for Social Research and Methods. Welcome all of you to the Roundtable.
Thank you.
Now, Sam Friedman, you went looking at how class works right now in Britain. Did the findings surprise you?
Yeah, I think they did, actually. I mean, we have a lot of discussion in the UK about social mobility, but we tend to think about that in relation to access. Who gets into the top jobs and how does that relate to their background? I suppose we were interested in what happens to people once they're in those jobs, in those sort of elite occupations or elite professions. And what we found was really quite striking. When you look at the earnings of those in these top occupations, you find that those from working class backgrounds earn on average 16% less than their privileged colleagues in the same sets of jobs. And interestingly, even when you sort of adjust for all sorts of meritocratic factors that might possibly explain that pay inequality, that doesn't in any way sort of explain this class pay gap.
So you've got a pay gap based on class. We're also aware of a pay gap based on gender. Do these add up?
Yeah, very much so. And actually, I would say they probably multiply, or our data shows, and we're using here really the most powerful data set that we have in employment in the UK, the labour force survey. And what it shows is that women from working class backgrounds face a very powerful double disadvantage. So we're talking on average here of nearly £19,000 a year that somebody from a working class background who's a woman is earning less than a man from a privileged background in the same set of jobs. So very much the argument here is not that the class ceiling is replacing the glass ceiling, but these are very much intersecting inequalities.
Okay, so you've got gender, which is a disadvantage in pay terms. You've got class, which is a disadvantage if you're from working class in pay terms. What about if you happen to be brown skinned? Is that a further disadvantage, Sam Friedman?
I'm afraid it is. I mean, we were really kind of shocked to see that these intersecting inequalities multiply as you look at them. So if you're looking at a non-white woman in the UK from a working class background, you sort of see this sort of triple disadvantage effect. It's not for all ethnic minority groups. Indian and Chinese populations, for example, in general sort of buck the trend in the UK. But generally, in terms of ethnic minorities in the UK, they tend to face this double disadvantage when they come also from a working class background and make it into these top jobs.
Professor Tony Bennett from the Institute for Culture and Society at Western University, tell me that couldn't happen here.
Oh, it certainly could, and it does, although not necessarily to the same degree and in exactly the same way. The work that I've been doing doesn't look at the work that Sam's been engaged with, looking at the higher end of the British class structure, and work that I've been engaged in Australia has been looking at the ways in which class, culture and privilege operate across class relationships as a whole, and in particular looking at the way in which the education system operates as a way of transmitting privilege across generations and for the accumulation of differences of income, status and power. based upon class. But of course, these are, as in the UK, they're complicated by questions of gender. We know there are ceilings in Australia in terms of how far women rise within political parties as well as corporations, a highly public issue at the moment. We also know that there are differences in terms of ethnicities. But like Sam said, in Australia, that wouldn't, you know, it's not true for all ethnicities. It's not, disadvantage isn't as true for Chinese and Indian migrants as it is for migrants from other backgrounds. And the history of migration to Australia, in any case, is different because of the point system that we've had, which mean that migrants enter into Australia these days at a different point in the class structure. So
education, yes. You mentioned education. I'm reminded of the late Christopher Hitchens, who recounted in his memoir, Hitch 22, how his mother was determined, as she put it, if there's going to be an upper class in this country, then Christopher is going to be in it. And that was the start of a process which began with boarding school at the age of 8. In the Australian context, how much does education determine, to the best of your knowledge, Tony Bennett, future opportunities in life? You go to school rather than the marks that you get?
It determines it extremely significantly. Our study shows that the likelihood of people... our study is informed by, as is Sam's work, it's informed by an argument that runs roughly along the following line. Children from middle-class backgrounds get an educational advantage that they acquire from the educational facility and knowledge of their parents and familiarity with high forms of culture at home. That translates into success at school, but it translates into success at school in different ways for different types of school. Success at school translates into success at university. Success at university translates into higher occupational positions, which means higher income, a likelihood of accumulating higher capital assets through life, and so on. Now, the work that we've done, which is based on a survey of 1,500 Australians, shows that you're much more likely to go on successfully through the education system if your parents have done it. If you go through the education system successfully, you're much more likely to end up in managerial positions, professional positions. If you go through the education system successfully, it's much more likely to happen if you've been to private schools and if you've been to state schools. And it's also much more likely to happen if you've been to religious schools, religious funded schools, as opposed to the state sector. Your chances of succeeding occupationally at the higher levels of the class structure are much more marked these days if you have a postgraduate degree as opposed to just a first degree. So that nexus of the relationship between home background, education, eventual class position is very clear and very strong in Australia.
Nicholas Biddle, you've been doing some work on Australian attitudes to class. And in a sense, what my reading of your research is that what we've just heard there from Tony Bennett, people actually know. They know it much more deeply than they perhaps want to let on, that they agree that there's class in Australia. They know or can identify for themselves where the class system runs for them.
Sure. So we asked in 2015, not too dissimilar size sample, around a little over 1,200 or so people, whether they could identify their own class position. And it's one of these things where you often go into surveys having a reasonable idea of what you're going to get. And I was actually quite surprised about the number of people who were able to answer or who did answer that question. Only about 6% or so of people couldn't really put themselves across a different class position, whereas about 57% of people put themselves in the middle class, 41% of people in the working class, and perhaps not surprisingly, only a very small percentage, I think about 20 or so people in our sample, about 2%, said they're in the upper class. People seem okay or able to answer that question and have a view about where they are in a particular society.
Now, interestingly enough, you also have come up with lists of class delineations within Australian society. How does your sort of technical academic view about where people sit within a class sit with how people themselves see themselves in that system?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So we followed there was a Great British Class Survey, which asked a similar set of questions to what we did, and we using measures of both cultural capital, social capital, and economic capital, we place people into six different, I guess, what you might call objective classes, or that's a bit of a loaded term. And the extent to which that correlated with people's self-assessed class wasn't as strong as you might think, in that there was a number of people who are in I guess in our hierarchy relatively low positions, who still identify themselves as being in the middle or even in the upper class. So there was some correlation, but perhaps not as strong as you might think, between where people are placed based on a range of characteristics and where people place themselves.
We're discussing class here at the round table. So on that basis then, Nicholas Biddle, people sense class, but they don't sense their class in the way that academics sense their class.
Sure, yeah, and I think that's a reasonable summation. And I think it's partly because there's a range of ways in which you can conceptualize class. So it could be your occupation, your economic position, what Sam used in quite highly in his work is around cultural capital, and so there's very different definitions, very different usages of the term class. So what we tried to do is come up with a measure which combined those. But obviously, when people are answering the question themselves, they might use one or a subset of those definitions.
So Sam Friedman, looking at the British experience, one of the things that comes through in your book is how subtle it is, so that if you have a workplace which has someone from a working class background coming into that organization, as you've proven, there's a pay gap as they go through that system. What are the processes by which someone from a working class background cannot flourish at the same level as those from a more upper class background?
Yeah, so we spend a lot of time. We went inside four sort of elite firms to try and answer that exact question. And we did sort of nearly 200 interviews trying to get to the bottom of that why question in relation to the class ceiling, the class pay gap. And there's a bunch of sort of mechanisms that emerge. One of them, you know, is the importance of family wealth, of the bank of mum and dad, if you will, that really acts as a sort of pivotal form of insulation from a lot of the uncertainties associated with forging a professional career, particularly in some of the more cultural elite occupations. We focused, for example, on television, and you see very clearly there that those who can rely on the sort of financial support of their parents, particularly through the early and mid part of their career, where they're often jockeying around for a permanent contract, and in the UK context have to negotiate living in London, which is obviously incredibly expensive. You really see the power of that sort of bank of mum and dad in scaffolding people's trajectories, whilst at the same time, those from working class backgrounds we found had often sort of sorted out of the most lucrative pathways to the top for more stable, more secure, but perhaps less prestigious sort of routes in admin, in marketing, in sales within the television industry. And so you really saw the power of sort of family economic capital, if you will, in helping propel some. There were a couple of other important ones. I think another interesting thing that people tend not to perhaps think about so much in everyday life is that there are very important sort of behavioral codes that tend to govern who fits within a particular workplace. And we found that these sort of were differed in important ways across our case studies, but to some extent were all sort of reflected the historical residue, if you will, of what type of person has done that work in the past and how have they been able to sort of institutionalize or embed their ideas about the right ways to be in the workplace. And this is often, you know, in the British context and particularly in elite occupations, the legacy of white privileged men. And what you saw was that what that means is that for people who sort of come through that mold, they tend to find that how to be at work sort of feels like sort of second nature, whereas those from working class backgrounds often finding that this sort of sense of the behavioral codes that govern You know, whether you appear to be somebody who feels like a partner, as someone said to us at the accountancy firm we were looking at, is often quite opaque and hard to navigate. You know, how do I think about self-presentation, about how to dress in the workplace, how to present myself, what sort of jokes to make, these sorts of seemingly innocuous and superficial elements that really are quite important in governing who appears to sort of feel confident or emboldened in the workplace.
It is subtle, isn't it? Professor Tony Bennett, you said before that the school that you go through can help you succeed through to university. But of course, people can get through to university from all kinds of backgrounds and can get equal degrees to those who go to the elite schools. Do you find a resonance in what we're hearing from Sam Friedman there from the British experience in Australia, that even matching degrees don't necessarily result in matching outcomes in Australian life?
Yes, I think that's true, in as much as, again, our data shows, and a lot of work on educational statistics in Australia will show, that your occupational chances are much better if you go to, if you acquire a degree from a Group of Eight university than from other aspects of the, you know, the university sector. So that there are networks there that operate, and there are undoubtedly professional cultures that are particular to specific occupations that, if you're coming from another class background, would feel a little bit strange and alien to you. It's probably the case in Australia that the kind of the degree of markedness around these differences may be less than it is in the UK. I mean, there is, as many people have described it, there's a culture of an egalitarian of manners in Australia. You referred to it at the beginning in, you know, a culture of mateship, even though that's a very kind of like masculine culture. Nonetheless, there is a sense of greater democratic mores in terms of the conduct of everyday life within Australia than was true of the UK, probably is still true of the UK, but less, much less than it used to be. But these things shouldn't take away from the fact of the differences in advantage and disadvantage that come from different class backgrounds. And this is not just a matter of the role of education in the transmission of advantage. It is also the role of laws, tax laws, and so on, in the transmission of financial advantage from one generation to the next. Sam referred to the importance of the bank account that your parents have. And if class is becoming more important today than it used to be, it's not just because of the transmission of inequalities through the education system. It's also because differences in capital ownership are increasing massively. So the work of Thomas Piketty has been really important here in pointing out that since the 80s, inequalities have been growing at a massive scale in societies like ours, and in particular, taking the form of inequalities between a top 10% of the population, and within that top 10%, a kind of really top 1% or 2% consisting of people who own significant large amounts of money that they've inherited, passed on from the past, and also CEOs whose remuneration levels have shot up over the last 20 years simply because of the capacity that they have, or their boards have, to set their own remuneration. I was struck by one of the things that Sam makes in his work, saying that there's a following wind of privilege can be misread as merit. And a following wind of capital inheritance can also be misread as merit.
So people who are in sort of privileged situations don't perceive that their successes are a consequence of their privileged situation?
Some do. I think some do. I think that there is a fair degree of awareness of this amongst many people, but very often people will pass off inherited advantage as though it were simply merit, and I think that, you know, it's simply not the case, really. I mean, you just have to look at the history of education to work this out. I mean, I'm a product of, you can probably hear in my accent, I'm British originally. I'm a product of the post-war expansion of university education that was made free to people in ways that had never been done before. I went to university with a grant provided by my local council, and this was opportunities that were unthinkable from my parents. Does that mean I was brighter than my parents? No, it doesn't.
Hmm. Nicholas Biddle, what do you think in the Australian context here? Do you think that it's becoming more a factor?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's there's a couple of other factors which kind of play out in Australia and as well as in other developed countries. I think the housing market is one, and I think if you look at the education system within Australia, both access to private schools, but also probably more so access to relatively well resourced public schools is highly influenced by where you live. And as we know, while income inequality in Australia hasn't necessarily changed as much as it has in other countries, certainly the housing market and the affordability has changed quite substantially. So where you live is a determinant of the schools which you have access to, as well as the social networks you have access to. I think the other point made about kind of the different migration system in Australia is a relevant one as well, and I think Sam mentioned there's particular people from particular ethnic backgrounds which have been shown not to be as affected by the class structure as others, but I think there's some work in Australia which has shown that once, as Sam mentioned, it's not just the getting in, it's the getting on within certain occupations, and that's I think where the data suggests there's barriers amongst those who on the outside might appear to have not necessarily been affected by the forms of discrimination which others have, but find it hard to progress in those relatively advantaged careers.
So in a national sense, if part of the job of any nation is to extract from its population the maximum from its gene pool of talent, Nicholas Biddle, class obviously acts against that as a national goal.
Yeah, so any barriers which get in the way of people being able to engage in the labour market in ways which they want, and also to make use of their other talents. And as mentioned, the education system is one, the housing market is another, the tax system. I think there's also some quite interesting research around kind of demographic factors and around assortative mating. So the extent to which increasingly, partners who are relatively advantaged, people who are relatively advantaged tend to have partners who are relatively advantaged. And that's partly to do with the education system, partly to do with the housing market as well, where that's the social systems which you're in, you're more interacting with people who are like you. And I think that's likely to translate into that those barriers of getting on. So if you have a partner who comes from a particular background which is well regarded in that particular occupation, then that helps not as much, but also helps your class position does.
We've got some a comment here. They didn't leave their name. Return of class? Question mark. Geez, it never left. Try my entire life. And from Tracy, a question: is accent more of a class indicator in the UK than it is here? I might hold that thought just for a moment to go to something else which emerges from Sam Friedman's book, The Class Ceiling. You've come up, Sam, with 10 points you believe could help fix it. I won't go through all 10, but one of them is ban unpaid and unadvertised internships in companies. Why would you do that?
Well, I think you see incredibly clearly that the sort of route in to a lot of top professions in the UK involve this sort of informal unpaid route where people take up these sorts of internships. I mean, and I'm sure in the media you'll be aware of it, and I'd be very surprised if the similar is not happening in Australia. And the thing about these sorts of internships is they very much rely on people who can afford, which is again why the Bank of Mum and Dad comes in, to sort of survive this period of sort of precarity that helps get them in the door, you know, helps get that foot in the door. And as far as we're concerned, it's a very straightforward piece of legislation that could sort of act to really mitigate the effects of that. And at the moment, you know, it's unpaid in relation to this issue of the Bank of Mum and Dad, and unadvertised, I think, is very much playing into this network's idea that often the sorts of opportunities that would allow you to get the foot in the door are about who you know. And often that's also about the sort of social capital, if you will. So what are the types of people that your family has brought you into contact with, and how might they be leveraged in these sorts of crucial settings to help you start the process of making a career? And again, I should say, this is a particular issue in the culture and creative industries, where the notion of how you get in and then navigate your way through often a very opaque world that doesn't seem to have a very clear cut sort of route, these things become more and more powerful.
Tony Bennett, banning unpaid and unadvertised internships, are you attracted to that as an idea?
Well, I don't know the detail. This is the first that I've heard of this concern, so it sounds to me a very interesting idea. And it's a pertinent one in Australia at the time that internships between the university sector and, you know, not just the corporate sector, but the public sector are increasing. But this is quite different from unadvertised internships. So I think that's one aspect of class, and Sam's concerns are at the processes of class reproduction at the upper echelons of the class structure. I'd just like to say that the person who texted in saying class had never gone in a way in Australia, I think that's entirely true. It's impossible to think that class relationships have not been a significant force within Australian history over the last 20 to 30 to 40 years. But what is happening at the moment is the increased salience of class in public discourse. And you can see this daily now in political discourse in Parliament. It's kind of much more manifest, I think, than it has been over the last, say, 20 years. So its salience is increasingly publicly recognised.
Another point that Sam Friedman makes in his book is to point out that equality laws cover gender nowadays, sexual orientation, race, religion, and so on. They don't cover class. Nicholas Biddle, we don't have much time left to us, but would you see an advantage in saying, look, class is class and it needs to be included in equal opportunity law?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge with that, of course, and that comes back to our work, is how do you identify class in an objective way when we have people giving different responses to surveys based on the types of questions which are asked. So in principle, there's some merit, but the challenge is how do you measure something which, as you said a couple of times, in Australia is not necessarily seen, at least over the long term, as being visible and very hard to identify.
Okay, doubtless it's a conversation we'll take forward in future. It certainly gives us plenty to think about, particularly if you're in the business of raising kids at the moment. Thanks so much, all of you, for taking the time. Sam Friedman, Associate Professor with the Department of Sociology at the London School of Economics and co-author of a new book, The Class Ceiling, Why It Pays to Be Privileged. Professor Tony Bennett is with the Institute for Culture and Society at Western Sydney University. And Associate Professor Nicholas Biddle, you just heard there, the Deputy Director of the ANU Centre for Social Research and Methods. And that's all we have time for. Thanks for listening. I'm Hugh Rimmington. Until next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.